Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're having a Zoom platform hearing today, which will be two oral arguments presented as well as non-oral cases to be addressed. Today is July 6, 2022. Counsel, I believe both of you have been at the appellate court before and you're familiar with the rules. All rules remain in place, including the responsibility to keep up with the time. I'm looking for it. I don't see it on my screen. The timer. You'll each have 15 minutes to present your case and 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'm going to ask our marshal if you could pull that timer up a little. Can you see it, Mr. McGraw or Ms. DeVos?
I can see it. Your Honor, I'm not able to see it.
Viewed.
Oh, no, I can see it. I can see it there, Your Honor.
We're good then. With that said, I'm going to have our marshal call the first case for presentation and consideration.
Your Honor, may I just one question before we get started?
Yes, Mr. McGraw.
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't see my client on the screen. Does anybody else see him, Mr. Owen?
There's a public observer. That's all I see.
Okay, that's good. I just wanted to make sure he was able to log in. Able to proceed, Your Honor.
And of course, these are available video-wise after the fact. All right, with that said, Joe Brand is our marshal today, if you'll call the first case for consideration.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Gaitis, Judge Smith, the Honorable Renee Werke presiding. Now Mr. calling.
McGraw. Mr. McGraw, when you're ready to proceed, please introduce yourself and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, Mr. Owen, my name is Beau McGraw. I represent the appellant in these proceedings. This is a case, an appeal based upon a denial of a post-conviction relief petition that was filed at the district court. The basis for the petition was an affidavit provided from an expert witness, one Dr. Fromm. Dr. Fromm provided evidence to the district court by way of affidavit, whereby she concluded that the complaining witness in the case experienced an alcohol-induced fragmentary blackout on the night of the alleged incident. While in an alcohol-induced fragmentary blackout, a person is aware of his or her surroundings in the moment and can make voluntary decisions and engage in a variety of complex behaviors, carrying on conversations, driving, engaging in sexual activity. And what Ms. Dr. Fromm told the court in the affidavit was that while the person would engage in those activities and the individual that the person is engaging with would acknowledge that there is, there's an interaction there and there's an engagement in those activities, the individual that is engaging and forming those conclusions is not forming a memory of what is occurring.
Mr. McGraw, you know that on a post-conviction relief petition, the burden you have is quite high if you're arguing that this is newly discovered evidence. As I understand it from your briefing, you're not arguing the interests of justice. What you're saying is that newly discovered evidence would suspend the time limit as far as the post-conviction relief. The problem I have is reviewing the affidavit that you're discussing from Ms. Fromm, it appears that the articles that she's written, the numerous statements that she has opined in, all predated any of the events that we're addressing today. So how is this newly discovered evidence? It would have been out there in the World Wide Web way back at the time of the incident.
Your Honor, let me address that with a little bit of context as how it relates to criminal jurisprudence in the state of Minnesota. So the state and the district court cited a couple cases when they dismissed this petition. The first case they cited was the Weiland case. And the second case they cited was the Blassus case, saying that expert affidavit is not newly discovered evidence. Let me tell you why this affidavit of Dr. Fromm is different and how we separate from those two cases. First of all, both the Weiland and the Blassus case relate to insanity-related defenses. And insanity-related defenses, we have 150 years of cases in the state of Minnesota where there is insanity-related defenses that are asserted. In both of those cases, Your Honor, what happened was there was evidence submitted to the district court at the time of trial whereby in both cases there was multiple experts that provided testimony related to the mental abilities of the defendant in the case. What happened afterwards is that defense through counsel went out and obtained a second affidavit. And in that affidavit, there was an opinion that differed from the first one. So first separation from those cases as to why it's newly discovered evidence in our case is no expert ever testified in the trial of Mr. Owen as to whether or not the complaining witness was incapacitated and unable to form consent or non-consent at the time of trial. So we don't have that. The second piece of the puzzle here is, if you did that same search in jurisprudence in the same state of Minnesota and tried to provide expert testimony, such as the one that Dr. Fromm is going to provide in this case, you wouldn't find a single case. Not one. This is certainly a case of first impression. It's the first time that there's been expert testimony that's been proffered to help explain what would happen in that dorm room on that night. Your Honor, what I would relate it to more so than Weiland or Blasis, where we're talking about expert testimony by affidavit form, that is probably cumulative to what was already provided in that case. This case is akin to eyewitness testimony, where you would receive by way of affidavit after a conviction, an affidavit where a witness comes forward that didn't testify at the time of trial, was not available at the time of trial, and provided testimony. What does that testimony look like in this case? This witness is going to come forward and she's going to explain what occurred in this dorm room on the night in question, where you have very, very young adults that had consumed alcohol. What was that interaction? How was the complaining witness communicating to the defendant? How was the defendant responding to that communication? That's her expertise. That's the testimony she's prepared to provide. This is the first time we've seen this in the state of Minnesota. I did an exhaustive search. I couldn't find a single other case. The state's had a chance to provide a response to the appellate brief, and they don't cite a single case. All they talk about is Weiland and Blasis. And Weiland and Blasis are not instructive to this court, again, because mental health defenses have gone through 100 years of jurisprudence, hundreds of thousands of cases in the state of Minnesota. Additionally,
Mr. McGraw, I'm still not clear on how this evidence wasn't available to the defense at the time of the trial. I understand that this is a newly obtained opinion, but that's not the test that we apply in determining whether evidence is newly discovered. And maybe you could help connect the dots on that.
So here's what I think, and I'm going to be as candid as I can with the court. I was handling cases like this back in 2017. This wasn't on my radar. I knew nothing of it. I know the defense bar generally in 2017. I'm not aware of anybody that was bringing these issues forward and defending somebody like Mr. Owen. And then when I look through the case law in the state of Minnesota, I don't find a single case where this was brought forward. Now, nationally, it sounds like there was some discussion. And nationally, everybody has, because of the web, we have the ability to see what is going on out there. But so much of the way law is practiced, especially in the state of Minnesota, I would submit to Your Honor respectfully, is regional. In that if there's no basis to believe that his defense attorneys at the time would have access to this information, and it wouldn't be fair to hold them to this standard when nobody else in the state of Minnesota seemed to employ this type of defense. And it's not even really a type of defense. It's an understanding of what was occurring during a very complex period of time with two very young adults. I think that while it's a vulnerability on this appeal, I recognize that. I'm going to be candid with you. There are articles out there in this nation where this item has been discussed. But I think what this court needs to do is focus on Minnesota. Is this something that was available in the state of Minnesota to defense counsel at the time? And there's no record of that. There's just no record of that. And if it would have been, I hope it would have been employed. Otherwise, it would have been ineffective assistance of counsel claim. But I don't think you can hold them to that standard when we didn't have this here then. And it is so crucial in a case like this to allow this type of testimony to come forward. The district court really, really got it wrong on this point.
Connect for me then also, if you will, you've got all these elements that you have to meet in addition to proving that this testimony would establish by clear and convincing evidence that the petitioner, in this case, your client, the appellant, would have been innocent.
Yeah.
We have a study. I don't know that it necessarily would exonerate him. I think it would be a matter of information that went to the jury as it did at the time.
So we won't ultimately know that unless this evidence was submitted to the jury. Okay. But this is what we know. We know that the state proceeded under Minnesota Statute 609.341 sub 9. And if we look at C of that statute, it reads this way: unable to communicate non-consent, and the condition is known or reasonably should have been known to the actor. So what Dr. Fromm would testify to, according to her affidavit, would be how a person would be acting in that state. That's what she would be testifying to. She would say that her studies that she's done over decades of time, what it talks about.
But what I'm getting at, Mr. McGraw, her affidavit isn't saying that she's met with your client, she's read the reports, and that these standards, as applicable to the specifics of this case, would result in his exoneration. I don't see that in the affidavit. I see many credentials in terms of what she's published and so on. But other than that, from Dr. Fromm, I don't see that tie-in.
And with all due respect, Your Honor, I think it would be improper for her to make that determination. She can't step into the province of the court of the jury. But
well,
if that's the case, then
how is it new evidence? We were back to that. If that is the case, how is it new evidence?
It's new evidence because nowhere in this transcript is there ever any explanation brought to the court as to how the complaining witness might be communicating with the defendant and how the defendant might be accepting that communication.
All right. Well,
that's how it's newly discovered.
One of your other issues is ineffective assistance of counsel, but as it relates to there wasn't any testimony to that, your client, Mr. Owen, indicated on the record that he intended not to testify, and there was the colloquy with the court, the record made that he chose not to testify, but could he not have also said and testified as to the elements that you're talking about now?
Well, I think he did. I think a lot of his testimony came in through the law enforcement interview that got in front of the jury. He testified and he provided a statement to law enforcement in that way. And his testimony was 100% consistent with the way Dr. Fromm has now interpreted the condition of the complaining witness. That's the important piece here, Your Honor. To get back to your last question about whether or not she can proclaim he's innocent, she can't do that. There has to be a hearing that does that. But what she did in exhaustive detail is she went through all of the points in the proceeding where the complaining witness provided her narrative. And what Dr. Fromm did in that setting is she formed a conclusion that she was, you know, for lack of a better way of explaining it, suffering from this phenomenon known as blackout drunk. And then she talks about what blackout drunk means. Blackout drunk means I'm passed out and I can't form consent or non-consent. What blackout drunk means is that I'm carrying on conversations, I'm having interactions with the person that I'm with, but I'm not forming the memories that allow me to recall those interactions the next day.
And that's when you get the allegations come forward. Mr. McGraw, as to the testimony that is relayed in the affidavit, one concern that I have is whether it would even be admissible at a trial. And specifically, would the experts' opinions about what was actually happening here be independently admissible, you know, apart from any scientific evidence offered? And if not, how would this how would this, again, satisfy the newly discovered evidence test?
So I think it would be admissible, but we don't know that because the district court didn't go through that analysis for us. We didn't have a hearing on admissibility. We didn't have a Fry-Mac hearing, for example. I have one example that might be useful. I just finished trying a case in federal court. It was a drug case. There was an expert that there was a stash house involved in the case. There was an expert that testified about his understanding of drug trafficking and the use of stash houses. No knowledge of the facts of that case, but that judge was admitted to testify in front of Judge Wilhelmina Wright in federal court about his knowledge of drug trafficking efforts and stash house related activities. I think we're even stronger than that here. I think we're stronger than that. Not only do we have her expert in the country on this blackout and drunkenness issue, she went through and she read every single statement that the complaining witness made in this case, and she formed conclusions about the complaining witness and her abilities to communicate on the night in question based upon her own statements. I certainly think it would evidence that would come in under 702, and we would certainly be able to comply with the Fry-Mac analysis. Here's one other thing. I just want to talk just briefly about the irregularity of the way this issue was addressed. Is, and counsel can verify this for the state. What happened was we filed this petition. My time's running low. I'm going to be quick. We filed this petition. We received a notice that the matter was going to be set on for a Rule 5 hearing, which is an arraignment at the district court, which I'm sure this court is aware of. We showed up there. Both attorneys thought we were scheduling this for a hearing, a contested hearing. And this was months after we filed the petition. When we got there, it wasn't that. The court wanted argument on the issue. The state hadn't even provided a response in writing to the issue. I had no knowledge of what their objections were going to be. That's how the issue was addressed. Then the court, you know, took brief arguments in a conversational setting and then issued a written order. It's the same way the previous post-conviction relief petition was addressed by the court. And I provide that not because I necessarily think we can get relief based on it. I provide it so you can see the context. What happened in that case?
I understand, Mr. McGraw. Your time has expired, but you will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal to expand on that if you wish, or any of the other issues.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Respondent counsel.
Good morning. My name is Susan DeVos, and if it may please the court, counsel, I'm here today representing the state of Minnesota, and we are asking the court to affirm the district court's decision, which in this case did correctly determine that there was no basis to proceed in any manner other than in the summarial fashion in which the court did, which was to dismiss the post-conviction petition. Going back to initially, I think there is a procedural issue primarily here with regard to appellant's timing. As the court's aware, and as Mr. Owen's counsel, Mr. McGraw, is aware, post-convictions normally must be filed within 2 years of the date the conviction becomes final. He doesn't seem to be disputing that he's missed that timeline. But they're also required to be filed within 2 years of the date in which the claim becomes known to them or should have been known. And in this case, there's no question that it should have been known within that 2 year time span, as the court has already pointed out.
Well, Ms. DeVos, let me ask you this question then, because as I heard appellate counsel arguing strenuously on behalf of his client that this syndrome, I'll call it a syndrome, blackout drunk is something that was unheard of conceptually in the state of Minnesota, and that this is new territory and this would make for a precedential opinion. What's your opinion on that?
Well, first of all, I don't think the standard is whether it's known locally or regionally. Certainly people gather experts from all over the United States, as Mr. McGraw has just done in this case. Provided
would that perhaps have went to the admissibility of the evidence if it had been proffered in due course of the trial?
Absolutely. That could have been considered at that time.
You've muted. I don't know why you've moved.
I'm sorry. I think I bumped. I bumped it. The hazards of Zoom. At this point, Your Honor, again, I'm not certain what you heard there, but regionally, that's the issue is not whether it's regionally available or talked about, and it's whether it is available. And as the court pointed out, in this case, it may have gone to the admissibility, but we don't even get there. And this isn't truly evidence. I think that that's another issue. But first of all, I think that they're off base and that this was filed too late. And secondly, just looking at whether it even is evidence at all is of concern. There's the four-part test that we look at, and primarily, if it doesn't meet the four-part test, then it can't go forward. And again, it's not new evidence. The Supreme Court has discussed that in a couple different occasions. I don't think that either Blasis or Whelan were limited to cases of mental illness defense, despite counsel's argument on that point. But if we look at the four-part test, whether he was aware of the issue, certainly this issue of whether the victim could consent was hotly contested at trial. There was not an expert brought in by the defense, but it was certainly the primary or a primary issue in the case. This is a new label, this blackout defense that he's raised. But as the district court pointed out, that doesn't make it new evidence. It could have been discovered with due diligence. That's the second factor. And the third factor, whether it would have been cumulative or could have been cumulative, again, this was something that we certainly heard about at trial. There was black spots in the memory, a different label, but certainly the same information. And whether it could have led to a different result. And that's just not clear here at all. And it has to be clear that it would have led to a different result. So,
Ms. DeVos, you indicated that with due diligence that should have been discovered and brought forward. Does that mean that trial counsel was not competently representing Mr. Owen?
First of all, not necessarily. That could have been a trial strategy. We don't even know whether they found that information, but they did make a decision not to bring in an expert. So certainly that was a decision made by trial counsel. I don't think it all leads to the ineffective assistance of counsel, but that does raise another point. Mr. McGraw does raise the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel, and the district court didn't address that in its decision, but that is certainly beyond the two-year point, Your Honor. That was raised in their initial post-conviction petition, which they dismissed, and now we're well beyond that point. It doesn't fall within any of the exceptions. They don't even try to come up with a way in which it does, and so any argument that it could be related to ineffective assistance of counsel is just simply waived by the timelines. So in essence, Your Honors, there's the first and foremost primary problem here with the newly discovered evidence issue is that we are just simply beyond the timelines, even outside of whether or not it is evidence, outside of the timelines, they're well beyond the 2 years. And then when you look at the evidence itself or what they've labeled evidence, it doesn't meet the four-factor tests as to whether it's newly discovered evidence. And when you look at their second issue, and the only other issue they've raised here is ineffective assistance of counsel, they're simply beyond the timelines. So, Your Honor, I know that Your Honors.
What about the ineffective? I'm assuming that we're going to get in rebuttal to the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, which is perhaps not Knopf-LaBarre. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, it was raised in their initial post-conviction petition as well, which was dismissed. And there has been, that was we're beyond the timelines as well with regard to all of that. And so at this point, Your Honor, yes, I believe that that is barred as well. Despite the numerous arguments, as the court has already highlighted the issues here, we're beyond the timelines. It's not newly discovered evidence. And there is simply no basis in which the court should look at the ineffective assistance counsel arguments. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. DeVos. We'll turn back to you now, Mr. McGraw, for 5 minutes for rebuttal purposes.
Thank you. I appreciate the additional time. So I want to come back to the black spot issue because I really think that that's so important as you analyze this appeal on the merits and deliberate about it. But I want to go back to the first post-conviction relief petition since it's been, I briefed it in here. Here's what happened. My client was still in prison. We filed that in November of 2019. We weren't given a hearing until October of 2020. By that time, he had been released from prison. By that time, we had been discussing other ways to remedy this injustice. That's what happened there. No timely hearing. It was just an afterthought. Then we file this subsequent post-petition relief. We get similar treatment. We think we're going to have a hearing. The court sends out a Rule 5 notice. Even the prosecutor had no knowledge that we weren't having a simple scheduling conference. Her and I met prior to talk about availability. So the way he's been treated in this process is entirely unfair, and it's inconsistent with the standard of due process in this state.
I understand you're advocating on behalf of your client, but just so that we're all clear on this, the issue of due process is not before us as far as this appellate hearing, is it?
It's not, but I want you to consider the way he's been treated in this process when you analyze the dismissal of this post-conviction relief petition. That's all I'm raising it for, Your Honor.
We've thoroughly read the record, and we understand the nuances of this matter and the tragedies as far as both participants are concerned. So we do understand that.
I so appreciate that level of care, Your Honor. Let's talk about black spots, and I'm going to end with this. So here's what happened in this trial. The complaining witness testified about parts of the event that she was able to recall. Those parts of the event that she was able to recall do not justify a conviction under 609.341 sub 9. I outlined those in the brief. The part of the trial that led to the conviction, which was C, unable to communicate non-consent, and the condition is known or reasonably should have been known to the actor, that's where we got into this black spot phase during the trial. And the only way, think of the jury in that position. They hear black spots. They think blackout. What do normal people think about that? They think somebody is just out, almost passed out. They use those words interchangeably. Dr. Fromm told us you can't use those words interchangeably, in that when she mentioned black spots, she's making references to being blackout drunk. And here's what that means. It means that somebody that's in that condition might not appear, likely would not appear, to be in a position to non-form, to make conclusions relative to consent and non-consent. The jury never got that. So for the district court and the state to say, these are old, tired issues that were brought to the jury, inferring that they were cumulative, but not really saying it, simply is not fair. This is newly discovered evidence in its clearest sense. Again, we don't have another case in Minnesota. So to start blaming other attorneys and to start saying due diligence should have brought this forward, it's not fair because it hasn't happened. There always has to be a case of first impression. Why can't it be this one? Why can't it be this one? We're talking about two young adults in a matter of minutes in a dorm room where they're trying to figure out, both intoxicated, what's going on. It would be so helpful to have somebody of Dr. Fromm's credentials to provide that context. Now, if we have a Fry-Mack hearing and the court determines that I can't get Dr. Fromm over that bar, then we have to deal with that. But we didn't even get a hearing here. My client's out of prison. He's working in the community. He's trying to clear his good name. Let's allow this process to start being fair to him. I'm asking that you vacate this dismissal. You remand this matter back to district court for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you to both attorneys for appearing today. The briefs were well done, as well as the argument that will assist us.